Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Mindset Advantage podcast, a show dedicated to insightful conversations in a world full of sound bites. Hosted by fitness coach, performance optimization coach, and national speaker, DJ Hillier. These podcasts are designed to help you attack the gap from where you are now to where you want to be. The episodes take a deep dive into leadership, mindset, and fitness. Follow the show on Instagram at Mindset Advantage Podcast and subscribe to his newsletter at djhillier.com. So let's get to it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is DJ Hillier, and you are listening to episode 344 of the Mindset Advantage Podcast. And before I tell you about today's amazing guest, I have some exciting news I want to share with you. In just a couple of weeks, I am going to release my first ever book. On April 27th, you can get your hands on Push the Sled, 7 Skills to Build an Elevated Mindset and Amplify Performance in Any Sport. This book has been in the works for the last 12 months, and I am so looking forward to the day that you guys can get your hands on it and get your copy and read it yourself. If you're looking to support me or support the book, I highly encourage you to not only buy the book, but buy it on launch day. If you can purchase the book on Amazon on April 27th and leave a review on Amazon, the combination of the purchase and the review helps exposure and helps climb the different algorithms that Amazon has to offer. So if you would, go ahead and purchase Push the Sled on April 27th on Amazon and leave a review. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much in advance. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you guys think about something that has been a deep work and a deep project for me and a deep passion for the last year. Today, I get to talk to Caroline Adams Miller. Caroline is one of the first 33 people in the world to attain the master's degree in applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of 8 books and that has been translated into multiple languages, including bestsellers titled Creating Your Best Life and Getting Grit. Caroline's work has been featured for decades in global media, including CNN and the New York Times. Caroline is a credentialed executive coach who works with senior leaders and their teams all over the world and is known for her pioneering evidence-based approach to goal accomplishments and its connection to flourishing. Some of the topics we got into were first understanding the difference between traditional grit and authentic grit. Caroline worked very closely with Angela Duckworth, who in many worlds is the queen of grit, if you will. And even Angela has such great words and praises for Caroline. And they worked together on a lot of things. And Caroline kind of added into Angela's definition of grit and kind of created her own wrinkle of authentic grit. And I really enjoyed learning and talking to her about that. After that, we talked about the mistakes most people make when discussing or talking about grit. We talked about how to use her bridge methodology, which I think is brilliant. After that, we talked about the key distinction between learning goals and performance goals. This is something that Caroline is extra fired up and passionate about. Then we talked about how the spelling bee shows grit in teenagers 20 years later. And then we talked about what it means to struggle well. There were tons and tons of topics, stories, and great pieces of wisdom in this episode. I highly encourage you to grab a piece of paper, grab a pen, write down some of the thoughts so you can come back to this episode and see how it changes your life. If you enjoy the show, please be sure to leave a rating, review, and share it on your social medias. Also, if you're looking to pick up a new book, go ahead and head over to djhillier.com/30books. I've compiled my list of my top 30 books that are written by Mindset Advantage guests. So you get the book, you get a little bit of a summary, and then you also get a link to the podcast where I talk to the author. You can pick that up once again at djhillier.com/30books. And finally, don't forget we are on YouTube. So if you want to watch some of these episodes on YouTube in the conveniency of your own home, head over to YouTube and type in DJ Hillier or the Mindset Advantage Podcast. Both should get you to our page. All right, without further ado, let's get to this awesome and insightful and passionate conversation with Caroline Adams Miller. Let's go. Caroline Miller, welcome to the Mindset Advantage podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. We're going to have some fun.
Oh, God, I'm so thrilled you invited me. Thank you.
I recently read your amazing book, Getting Grit, The Evidence-Based Approach to Cultivating Passion, Perseverance, and Purpose. Loved this book. I went through it once, another halftime through. And one of the cool things about this is Angela Duckworth says that you're the person who thinks more about grit than anybody she's ever met. So I'm curious to kind of start, set the table with you today. First, such high praises from such an amazing woman. I think we need to first start with setting the table, Caroline. What is grit? What isn't grit? Let's set the table first before we get into the nuances.
Ooh, okay. Gosh, there's so much there. Okay. What is grit? There's Angela's definition, which is passion and perseverance in pursuit of long-term goals. And then when I wrote Getting Grit, with her blessing, I mean, she was just thrilled that I went into a whole different area of grit. I really started to believe as I looked at my client load, mostly CEOs at this point, I've had 25 years of coaching all kinds of people, including athletes, the grit is only good when in the process of being that person, others who witness your behavior, your humility, your perseverance, your dedication, your passion, your willingness to do hard things without a trophy. I believe that it has to awe and inspire other people who want to be better too. So to me, it's a collective strength at this point that the world needs. It's not just about you or me getting gritty. It's about in the process of being that authentically gritty person, going out of your comfort zone to live your best life, to take risks, to do your absolute best at whatever it is your goal is, I do believe that it has to make the world better in one way or another.
What do you think most people get wrong about grit?
I think there's a self-focus. I think too often people think it's just about working hard, banging your head against a wall, showing up over and over. I've got story after story of people who have what I call stupid grit. So it's not just about being a hard worker. It's also not just about being resilient. It's not about just having heart. How often have we heard someone has heart? It's something different. What grit is it's baked in that you're going to be pursuing something that's important to you, maybe not to anyone else, but to you, and you're going to do it for a long period of time, and you're going to do it in the absence of sometimes cheerleaders, sometimes people believing in you, but it's something that takes a long time, and it's often a very lonely journey.
Mm. Thank you for breaking that down. You talk about authentic grit in the book, and your definition is the passionate pursuit of hard goals that awes and inspires others to become better people, flourish emotionally, and take positive risks and live their best life. Yeah. Initially, when I read that, I was thinking to myself, well, why does it matter what other people think about how we go on our pursuit and our grit? But I love the way you said that. You changed my mind there. And it's more about, I want to have grit so I can make the world a better place. Not, I want to have grit so other people accept me or other people feel good about me. There's a little bit of a difference there.
Yeah. So it's like in positive psychology, it's not about chasing happiness. Happiness is a byproduct of doing other things. Impacting other people is a byproduct of doing grit the right way. And so it's not that you're choosing to do something so that other people will be elevated. My perspective is that it's a byproduct of authentic grit. And I think, and I've got stories about this, it uplifts and inspires other people in ways a speech can't, a movie can't. It's about witnessing, and I love the word witness. It's about witnessing something that makes you ask yourself, wow, what if I lived like that? What might I be capable of doing so that I leave it all on the floor?
I love that. You have a story. I'll tee up a little bit. I heard this recently on one of your keynotes on YouTube about a woman who was in a swimming pool. And it was somebody who really showed a lot of grit. I think when we're trying to, you know, put a visual to what grit is, this story is phenomenal. Do you remember it? Would you mind telling it?
Yeah, I forget her name. I think it was Annie, but she was at a master's long course nationals at the University of Maryland. And I was, you know, like you get nervous between events and I'm shaking out my arms and I'm walking around and I'm just thinking about me. And suddenly this buzz starts in this natatorium, like 1,000 people buzz. And I look around and I go, what's happening? And somebody said to me, That's Annie so-and-so. She is about to break a world record. And I look over, I grab my phone, I take a picture, and I see this grinning woman. She's in the pool with one hand on the wall and everyone else is on the blocks. And she, on your mark, get set, go. And this woman starts swimming. And I just hear the buzz getting louder and louder, the cheering. And so to cut to the chase, she finishes, the place erupts, she set a world record. She was the high point winner of the entire nationals meet. She was 99 years old, and she had started swimming at the age of, I think, 90 because she didn't want to be bored.
Wow.
And this was someone who was living her best life. She was doing hard things because it turned her on. But in the process, I was a better human being for having witnessed that approach to competition, to grit, to perseverance, all of it. And I just got goosebumps when you said, that's the story I want you to tell. That's the impact other people's authentic grit has on us. It elevates us. It awes us. I was awestruck. So here's something else I've noticed about authentic grit. When we're in the presence of somebody who's doing something authentically gritty, I find that we get to our feet. So I'm thinking standing ovations when you witness this magical musical experience, or think about a baseball no-hitter. Think about, when do people get on their feet and just stand there and stare at the pitcher, like the sixth inning, because people are witnessing greatness and they know it doesn't come along very often. So think about the times when you get to your feet almost involuntarily. You're rising because you're in the presence of someone who is doing something exceptional, not for you, but because it lights them up. There's this wonderful word in Yiddish, sitzfleisch, which means an inner fire that's just burning inside of you, and it makes you do hard things.
I love that. What a tremendous example. I think another piece of grit, as you explain it that way, is there's a longevity component to this, isn't there? Yeah. I think sometimes I like to kind of clarify and demystify the myths of some of these terms. One thing somebody could say is, I'm too old to have grit, or maybe I had grit back in my 20s and my 30s. It was a lot easier to have grit there. I had more energy. What I'm hearing from you is that grit is a lifetime pursuit. We can have that up into our 99 years on earth. Talk to me a little bit about what does grit have to do with the aging process?
Wow, that's so interesting. So the reason why I decided to write this book was because, let me back up and put the book in context, and then I'll answer that. So when I wrote Creating Your Best Life, which was my fifth book, that was my capstone at Penn, that was the first book ever published for the mass market that had science with goals, goal setting theory, and I attached it to the science of happiness. And in the process of researching that book, I found research showing that the happiest people wake up every day to hard goals. Not easy goals, hard goals, pre-planned goals. And at the end of the day, whether we know it or not, we scan our days for what we did that day that was hard, because that's where we get confidence. That is what builds authentic self-esteem. You can't buy it. You can't give someone a trophy and make it happen. So anyway, in the process of writing that book, Angela was running in and out of the classrooms at Penn where I was getting this master's degree. It's like, who is that? What is she researching? Why is Marty so excited about her? And that's when I found out about grit. And I thought, okay, A plus B equals C. If the happiest people wake up to hard goals, not easy goals, this grit thing, this X factor that she is looking into, I have got to figure out how to grow it. But can you grow it? That was my question. Can you grow it? So, because I didn't want to write a book about something you're born into. That wasn't interesting to me. So I was living in Rewind that year at Penn. And what I realized is I grew grit in my 20s when I overcame bulimia, back when nobody got better. Nobody got better. It was a death sentence. So I told Angela about this and I said, I think I grew grit one day at a time in my 20s. Before that, I was at Harvard. I had these degrees. I had this stuff. I had this billboard resume. But that wasn't grit. That was like talent. And so I decided to write about grit because you can grow it. And so you can grow it at any age, back to your point. And as we get older, we may or may not get grittier. Grit is a choice. Mm. Grit is an inborn. Grit is a mixture of behaviors, mindset, and hardwiring. And so you can grow it at any age. You can grow it at 90. I looked up that woman. She was a stud. Let me tell you, she was one of the first engineers in the country when she was in her 30s in Georgia or something. I mean, she'd had grit for a long time. This was her life. Kitty Ledecky lives around the corner from me. I grew up. I took her to swim practice a few times. That girl's been gritty since the day I met her at the age of 5. So she's had a lifetime of grit. A lot of people have a lifetime of grit. But here's the interesting thing. This is really important. Is gritty people who have good grit, authentic grit, they don't choose to be gritty at everything. They choose to really be passionate about the things that matter most to them. If they lose at Scrabble, it's okay. They might not like it, but it's not stupid grit all the time. So, long answer.
I want you to keep going on that last part. That's interesting to me. Can you expand on that a little bit more about they're not gritty on everything in life? Yeah. I haven't heard that before.
Okay. So in the book, I wrote about Bob Valorant's research on passion. And so there's two kinds of passion. There's harmonious passion and there's obsessive passion. Harmonious passion are people who have, the only analogy I can think of that everyone will get is a boyfriend or girlfriend who makes them a better person. I just went to my son's wedding. It was harmonious passion. You know, they make each other better, but they're not obsessed with each other. They're just better together. Obsessive passion is when you have to be the best at everything. You're obsessive, let's say, about being a great basketball player. And that's all you think about. It's all you do. You can't put it in a context. You think about it, dream about it. And if something doesn't go your way, the setback is so severe that you can't get over it. You obsess, obsess, obsess. So people who have good grit have harmonious passion. They're passionate about it. They want to do their best. And they often want to do their best against other people who are great. They don't like easy wins. But they have other things going on in their lives. They're loved by other people. They have a place where they can put this passion and let it rest if they don't get what they want. I just finished watching Full Swing. Oh my gosh.
Phenomenal.
I'm not a golfer. We belong to a country club that everyone wants to golf at here in Washington, Congressional Country Club. So I see these golfers arriving. And the thing I took from that is that they all have grit, but the ones who come out of the destructive losses are the ones who've got a basis of other things going on in their lives. For them, golf is harmonious passion, not obsessive passion. I just saw that kind of good grit playing out on both seasons.
Okay, there's so many things I want to get into. You got me fired up, Caroline. Okay, so first thing is you talked about going through hard things. And so the correlation here is that grit, to paraphrase what you're saying, grit comes through hard experiences, mm-hmm. and gritty people have hard goals. So there's this... Yes. There's this circle here of wishing for hard things. You grow through hard things. You talk about confidence. That's one of the things that I preach a lot about, is trying to help our youth become more confident, especially in the sports arena. And I think paraphrasing some of the things I've heard from you is that confidence comes from doing hard things, overcoming hard tasks. So can we double down? Can we double click on that importance? Because I think there's a lot of juice in there on wishing for hard things, overcoming hard things. Talk to me there.
Okay, so there's so much in there, and there's gender differences in confidence. So we need to break this down. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. And I think only recently have we begun to break psychology research down into genders. You know, men are often too confident, but they're not as competent as they think they are. And the same thing for women. They're not always confident, but they're more competent than they think they are. So that's a whole different conversation. So let me think, where should we just start with this? So people who have good grit, they want to find out what they're made of. And they often use their top 5 character strengths in the process of doing these hard things. They want to find out what they're made of, but not only that, they want to find out how much other people support them as well. I find that they want to know who's in their corner, who's at their bench, where's their soft place to fall. But mostly they have this longing to see, what if I live like that? What if I went for it? What if I doubled down? And you see this on Dancing with the Stars. I think people are so fascinated by Dancing with the Stars because they see people just leaving it on the floor. They don't know how to dance. Damn, they're out there trying. We are transfigured fixed by people who leave it on the floor. And so they don't go for easy goals. They go for hard goals. Now, my next book is called Big Goals, and I'm going to demystify goal setting and goal setting theory. So Locke and Latham are both still alive. Goal setting theory is how you should be setting goals, big goals. But most people think SMART goals is science. It ain't. It's not. SMART goals isn't goal setting. OKRs and KPIs, not goal setting theory. Everyone should know Locke and Latham's goal setting theory, what their findings were starting in the 70s, 80s, 90s, up till today, is that the best outcomes to any goal, bar whatever kind of goal it is, it could be a performance goal or a learning goal, has to be challenging and specific. So that's really important. It's not only do you want to thrive emotionally, the happiest people set hard goals. And at the end of the day, you scan your day unconsciously, subconsciously, what did I do today that I'm proud of? And it's always the hard things. What we know is that hard goals elicit best performance. And too many people set low goals or no goals because they don't want to disappoint themselves. And so let me just pause there and let's go into the next part of that.
I want to quickly double click on the performance goal versus learning goal. That's interesting to me. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Okay. So I'm on a mission to make sure every elementary school, middle school, high school, university student knows this. Goal setting theory was introduced to me when I was at Penn. And I remember, so 2005, I was introduced to Locke and Latham's goal setting theory, and I was working as an executive coach, as a goal setting theorist. My great uncles won the Olympics. They're the first siblings to go 1-2 in the Olympics. I was fascinated by goal setting. I was an athlete, and I thought I knew the science of goal setting until that classroom at the University of Pennsylvania. And one of our assignments was goal setting theory. And I remember thinking, what? Are you kidding me? There's a science. Who are these people? It's ranked number one of 73 management theories. Since that day, Creating Your Best Life was the first mass market book to put it out there. But too many people have absorbed this idea that there's SMART goals or OKRs. Okay, so Locke and Latham said two very important things. There are two kinds of goals, all right? The most common goal is a learning goal, something you've never done before. So let's say you join a company for the first time, or you join a team, or you're trying a sport for the first time. You are learning how to play that sport. You're learning how to have that quarterback join your team. You're learning how to, I don't know, swim butterfly, whatever it is. But you're learning, in which case that's the only time you can say do your best for a short period of time. Do your best. So learning is something you haven't done before. Now, you flatten your learning curve as fast as you can, because then it becomes a performance goal. And a performance goal is something you have done before. You know the standards of excellence. You know what it takes to be outstanding or elite. And so that lends itself to a checklist approach. And then and only then can you set a date and a specific outcome for that goal. So that's the difference, a learning goal and a performance goal. And I am writing this book, it's coming out in November, because I am stunned that the world doesn't know the number one theory on goal setting. Just stunned. I just got back from Malaysia, 200 CEOs staring at me, and I'm teaching an 8-hour workshop on goal setting. How many of you have heard of goal setting theory? Every one of them runs a company. All of them. Not one hand went up. Zero. This has been my experience since 2005, is that everyone sets goals and nobody knows the science of it. And they said there are two kinds of goals, just to recap: learning goals, things you haven't done before, and performance goals, things you have done before. These are the ones where you can set, I want to do this time, I want to have this handicap by this date because I know how to do this thing, and there's nothing else to learn. Learning goals. I've never done it before. Maybe the world has never done it before. I'm coaching the CEO of a big space company. The world's never done some of the things she's doing. So she's in a learning goal condition, but you flatten that learning curve as fast as you can. You ask people, you study YouTube, you read biographies, you do whatever you can to learn as fast as you can. And then it becomes a performance goal. So the book goes into it in great detail. I want everyone to have that book on their desk, on everywhere, because everyone should know it. You want to hear more about that and why I feel so strongly about it?
I do. I love seeing you passionate like this.
I think it can save the world. I have three adult children who were all raised during the period of, sorry, I'm having this allergy attack Raised During, everyone's a winner. So they got trophies for nothing. They got trophies for showing up. It was crazy. So we had an entire generation raised with self-esteem parenting. And this generation is anxious and has had so many suicides and so much depression. And it's contagious. And I've watched them. Every one of my children has had friends commit suicide. And my husband and I never had a single friend commit suicide. And I watch this. And I think what's happened is that this generation was not taught how to do hard things. They were told that they could just get whatever they wanted. And they were often given what they wanted for no work, little work. Grades went crazy. You know, grade inflation. Playgrounds got dumbed down. You can't sled because you might break your arm. Nothing was hard. Comfort animals everywhere. And I believe that this is a generation that feels completely overwhelmed by the dreams they have, and they don't know how to accomplish them. And I believe if we start teaching the science of goal setting young, and we teach children how to break down their dreams into goals the right way, the scientific way, we give them the keys to the kingdom for the rest of their lives. And that's why I think it's going to save the world.
I love it.
Change the world.
I love it. You talk about, do you think that most people jump to performance goal first, and that's the mistake that they make, that they're like, they see what they want on TV and then they're not really sure how to get there. One of the things I teach, Caroline, is this idea of process over outcome. So with my kids, I talk about, hey, we really want to get inundated with the process, right? Because the outcome, you standing on the podium, is a very quick time. You're up there for 4 minutes, you take a picture, great. I need you to be obsessed and love the passion, the process of you getting there, the day-to-day work. Is there some similarities in what we're talking about here, process over outcome, performance-based goals, or am I reaching?
No. I mean, it's very nuanced, but you're right on target, because let's say somebody knows how to do the sport that they're doing. And for them, it might be about upping their training, running faster intervals. It might be changing the training group they're in so that the norms are just faster and harder. For them, it might be a performance goal. Now, for people who are learning new ways to do it, let's say Tiger Woods, learning how to swing differently, learning how to putt differently, there's going to be a learning goal component. So it can't be a performance goal. You can't win the Masters when you're changing your putting. So you have to fall in love with the process, not everything is a nail, and not everything we do to get there is a hammer. So sometimes the nail is going to be working harder and having more grit. Other times it's going to be about learning how to be that person in the process of enjoying the journey, but also adding new components of who we are to that process. So for some, it'll be a learning goal. Some, it'll be a performance goal. Now, to just get way more nuanced, there's research by Gabriel Adigan about mental contrasting. And if you spend too much time imagining yourself on the podium at the Olympics, Tour de France, whatever, the research is pretty clear that if you spend too much time in the future fantasizing about this, you'll start to think you did the work. And so mental contrasting says that's not where you need to dwell. You might want to go there quickly. You got to have a North Star, but then you come right back to where you are today. How am I going to get there? And so I have this bridge methodology that I'm breaking out that's going to be in this book, Big Goals, because you have to go through, for me, a six-step process. It's brainstorming the relationships that you want to have in your life, the investments you need to make, what's your decision-making matrix, good grit, and elite performance. And every one of them has to be thought through very carefully in order to have a strategy in place. And if you skip any one of those steps, it's like Prochaska's Stages of Change, you're going to have to go backwards. And so it's a process. So, you know, it's a little more nuanced than people think, but I want everyone to just take this 120-page book, go through it, you know, just have their, you know, their plan in place and just go through it little by little. I want everyone to understand how to do this with the science, and you have to go through the brainstorming, the relationships. Let me just say something about relationships. A lot of people don't realize, and women in particular, women are surrounded by frenemies, friends who are enemies. And that's because we're acculturated. Women are to just be nice, you know, just don't let anybody think you're not nice. Unfortunately, Shelley Gable's research at the University of California, Santa Barbara, says that the first person you share your goal with, that person and their response is how you're going to pursue that goal. And so for a lot of women, when another woman dares to be ambitious and goal-oriented, the first reaction they get is off with her head. something passive destructive to something active constructive. And that's the book that is coming out next year. But anyway, so you have to be really careful. It's not just who should be in your life, it's who shouldn't be in your life. And not enough people think about that. When Dara Torres was training for the 2008 Olympics, remember she got a silver medal in the 50 meter freestyle at those Olympics, the Beijing Olympics? She was 40 years old, 41 maybe. Her father was not permitted to be in her presence the year before the Olympics because he didn't believe she could win a medal. You have to narrow it down to who believes in you. How do you know? And we know from psychology, there is a tell, and that is, are people curious and enthusiastic when you share your goal? If they're not curious and enthusiastic, out.
Get out. Would you mind? I love this. I would love to go a little bit deeper on these six steps. So we talk about brainstorm, we talk about relationship. Would you mind going through, can we go through 3, 4, 5, 6, or is that
yes,
private information?
No. I'm right in the middle of writing them.
It's top of mind. What's number three on that list?
Okay. So there's brainstorming. The number one thing that everyone has to do is sit down and brainstorm, and not just brainstorm with the people around you. This is where some of the biggest mistakes are made in corporate America. Think about Boeing. I call it the Habsburg jaw effect, where it's a lot of white men similar to each other, same schools, who just sat and had confirmation bias. When you're brainstorming, the first thing you want to ask yourself is this a performance goal or a learning goal? And then you have to ask yourself a series of very disruptive questions. You know, has anyone done this before? Is there a new way to do this? Is it better? How can artificial intelligence help us do this better? Becoming more efficient and more effective. So that's a whole chapter. And I use first principles thinking. Elon Musk uses that. So that's in that chapter. Relationships, critical. In positive psychology, one of the first things you learn is that happiness boils down to one phrase: other people matter. So the key to being happy is to have positive, strong relationships. And I can't tell you how many athletes, how many people's lives are short-circuited and devalued because they're surrounded by the wrong people. If you want to change a habit, change the circle you're in. There's all this great research by Nicholas Christakis on social contagion theory. We catch behaviors. Angela Duckworth found that at West Point, the grit scale is what determines who drops out during Beast Barracks. That's in my book. Everyone knows that research now. Anyway, so what do they do at West Point if you have a low grit score? They room you with a high grit score because the behaviors are contagious. You see what it takes to just go a little bit further and you start to catch those behaviors. So relationships really matter. Investment. So when you're pursuing a goal, you have to ask yourself, what do I have to invest in terms of time to accomplish this goal? Do I need to take a course? Do I need to invest money? How am I going to use my character strengths, the investment of those? There's so many ways you have to look at investments. Decision-making. So many people have never thought through when they make their best decisions, what's their process? So as I said, I work with a lot of CEOs and a lot of them have never thought through that they've made their best decisions, let's say when they've had a certain COO or a CTO or a CFO around them to, you know, break head, you know, not knock heads against each other, just be disruptive. Some people ignore their gut and their gut has always been part of it. So decision-making matrices, looking at game theory is really important. How are you making your decisions? But not only that, when are you going to pull out? When are you going to say sunk costs? That's an economic theory. And that's Dan Kahneman, who just died. So anyway, so when do you stop pursuing that goal? Good grit. That's so it's B-R-I-D-G-E. So good grit is number five. Do you have grit? And so there are several behaviors and mindsets that go along with grit. Sometimes you have to learn how to change the channel in your head. When you interview people who have good grit, I find all the time that ahead of time, they know that they're going to have to go in a pain cave. Let's say it's physical. They've got to go in a pain cave. They've got to, you know, design it. They've got to say, when I feel this thing in my body, I'm going to have to crawl in that cave. And here's what I'm going to say to myself, or here's what I'm going to see. Some people have a spiritual phrase. Some people have, there's so many different ways to change the channel in your brain, but good grit involves behaviors. It involves humility. Gosh, this is so discussed. Is intellectual and social humility are two of the qualities that you see in people with good grit. Intellectual humility, because they are they want to know everything they need to know, and they're not afraid to have people see that they don't have all the answers. They want to know, is there a better way to shoot a three-point shot? Look at Steph Curry. I mean, he just was relentless. How do I do this better? Who do I have to look at? What do I have to study? That's intellectual humility. Social humility is giving credit to the people who have helped you, not needing to suck all the oxygen out of the room. Then there's willpower. My God, this generation, or our world, US in particular, self-regulation is one of the lowest strengths on most people's VIA character strengths profile, because we live in a society where it's hard to wait. We're not often told that we should wait or have to wait. I mean, we can text an emoji of a pizza and the pizza will arrive at the front door. I mean, you don't even have to stand up. So you have to learn how to be persistent. And so sometimes I just say to people, start by being a finisher. If you get on the treadmill and you put in 45 minutes, don't get off at 41. Another interesting thing I'm sure you just saw in my book is Roy Baumeister, who's really the guru of self-regulation. He told me in an interview that the number one underminer of all goals is alcohol. Number one. And that's so interesting to me, because when I overcame bulimia, one of the first things I did was I got sober, because it removes all of the confusion, the slippery slope. Anyway, that's a long story. Okay, so that's, where was I? Good grit. And the last one is elite performance, excellence. What is the standard that you're shooting for to accomplish this goal? So you'll always get best performance from things being challenging and specific, but sometimes it's just about being good enough, given where you are in the stage of doing this goal. Don't always shoot for perfectionism if it's just about getting a step in place. So if you're looking for a specific big outcome, challenging is specific. If you have to just leverage the steps, sometimes you just want to be a satisficer and not a maximizer. So those are the steps. There's a 9-page chapter on all of them in the book.
I can't wait to read more. That's phenomenal. So let's recap. So brainstorm, relationship with others, investments, decision-making, good grit, and then elite or excellence, and whatever that means to you. I'm curious, as we kind of close that piece down, put a button in there, what do you think out of those six most people struggle with, Caroline? What's the one that's like, gosh, that one trips most people up? And do you have a strategy to help them?
I'm of the belief right now that brainstorming is where people don't do the work. Because I think people just want to jump into action. They want to just get going. They want to start to get some early wins. So I think people struggle with the fact that sometimes you have to lay the groundwork by really thinking something through, doing the research, or lawyers talk about due diligence. And so it's not physically hard, but emotionally, you might just not want to sit there and do it. So it can take the most time, but when you build that platform, that mental and emotional platform, and even financial platform, you're building a solid place from which you can jump off. And you may have to do a lot of that brainstorming alone. That was something Angela Duckworth found when she was studying the National Spelling Bee winners. She found that they didn't have parents like quizzing them all the time, doing flashcards. She found they did a lot of solitary work, and that they made themselves do this solitary work, studying, you know, the roots, the Latin roots of different words. And people with good grit, they hate doing this solitary hard work as much as everybody else does, but they find a way to do it. And so I found that really, really interesting, is that some of this brainstorming, this putting the pieces together, will be by yourself. So that's, I'll just leave it there.
I love it. One of the things you just brought up was a story that I loved in your book about the spelling bee. I thought this was so cool. I hadn't heard this before. So the listeners out there that haven't, can you talk about a little bit of the research in there? This was really cool.
Yeah, this is fascinating. So, I mean, Angela's brilliant, and she is a friend, and that was so nice of her to endorse my book, because she studies it and I work with people to build it. So it was just such a complimentary approach we took. So she decided to study 9 to 12-year-olds, I think in some cases 8 to 12-year-olds, because she was curious. She studied the West Point cadets. Like, what does it take to get through Beast Barracks that first summer? Because West Point didn't figure it out. She figured it out. And then she's like, well, how early can you see grit? Now, we know that little girls have more self-regulation and willpower than boys do. So they start with a little advantage. Okay. But what she found by sending questionnaires to the spelling bee contestants was that even at that young age, they demonstrated grit because she found that the ones who made it to the final rounds were often the ones who had finished out of the money, essentially, in the previous years. And they just went home and they worked harder. They found more words to study. They found new ways to, you know, isolate themselves and study. And so there's something called the psychology of the near miss, which I find fascinating. And what it means is that when you work hard to accomplish something and you miss it, a lot of people double down and they work harder. The disappointment is not as profound as we as parents might think. They double down. So she saw that in a certain percentage of these students who just went back and worked even harder. So the ones with the highest grit scores were the ones often in the final rounds who had not made it to the final rounds in previous years.
And then what you found later was that you or Angela found later that some of these people that finished really high had really high grit. And then, you know, 15 or 20 years later, where were they?
Yeah. So she hadn't looked at that. I did. So I was really curious about this because I looked at all the spelling bee and then I was like, well, what happens to them? And I went and found doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs, and they all said that the building blocks of their grit started when they realized they could do hard things by themselves and they saw the payoff. Society rewards people who do hard things. What's interesting, and I was just writing about in this book, is that when we pursue easier goals, we're usually happier in the process of doing that because we get more wins along the way. However, longer term, when you choose the harder goals that take more time and grit is baked in as a necessary ingredient, the happiness is more profound and longer lasting. May not have it all along the way, but damn, at the end, it's like, I did that. I think what you do is you redefine who you are to yourself. And we don't get many opportunities in life to change our self-perception. We only get a chance to redefine ourselves and see ourselves as someone who's stronger and more resilient than we thought we were only when we've done this and we can look back and say, I did that.
That is wisdom right there, Caroline. That is good stuff. I can't agree more. I want to go back to now, going back to one of my notes here. We talked about full swing. When I think about grit, and I haven't done nearly close to the amount of research that you have, but when I close my eyes and think about people who are gritty, my layman's term or my thought is that it's people that have a good relationship with failure. And you talk about it's people that struggle well. And I love this. I love this idea. They have a good relationship with if they get second place, they come back stronger, right? It's not the people who they lose a match and they're like, F this, I'm out of here, I'm done. They have this good relationship with, you know, failing might not be the right term, but losing, whatever you want to call it. And so you'd say in your book, what separates people who don't have grit from people who do is often this issue of working hard and overcoming difficulties without losing focus, equanimity, or passion. I really like this topic because with the youth athletes I work with, this is a big deal. How do you respond when things aren't going well? How do you respond when you lose? What's your relationship like with failure? We talk about self-regulation, people going up and down. You lose a game, it's like the biggest deal ever.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that struggling well piece. I love this stuff.
Well, you know, this is something, again, I saw in Full Swing. Who's that British golfer? Matt Fitzgerald?
Yes.
The one from England?
Yes.
Okay. And so I don't want to give away the whole series, but what I was so struck by was he wasn't succeeding at first, but he's kept these diaries of every round of golf he's ever played, the clubs he used. And so people with grit, they go back and they think, I need to study this in order to see where I can improve a little bit. So they don't give up. They have a certain amount of confidence again in themselves that they believe that they can do more, be better. And this is what Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset. And she found that this word yet is so powerful when you're talking to, you know, students, young athletes, ourselves, is it's not that I didn't succeed. It's like I didn't succeed yet. There's more to learn. You know, in the military, it's after action reviews. When I work with companies, it's about doing pre-mortems, you know, figuring out ahead of time what could possibly go wrong, because things will go wrong and we have to prepare for that. The Stoics had this all figured out. They called it premeditatio malorum, premeditate the evils that are coming. And so if you go into something expecting that it's going to be some kind of walk through the park and you're going to win and there's not going to be setbacks, That's insane. Because even when you're writing code for in computer world, when you're writing code, you write code expecting bugs. You expect it. And so as a result, the program doesn't work. You go back, you fix it. So I just think we have to see ourselves as works in progress. And that this is where I think we really hurt an entire generation by making them happy at all costs. It's a crazy story in my book about a swim team that removed the record board from the pool deck because they thought the kids would be upset if they saw how fast swimmers had gone before. I mean, are you kidding me? I literally still can't wrap my head around that. So we took away failure, the idea of failure. And as a result, a lot of people don't believe they have what it takes to overcome it. But I think people are more resilient and we need to presume strength, not fragility, in the people we're working with.
I love it. So what I'm hearing is teaching that we're works in progress, teaching the word yet, having more of it. It's almost like an infinite vision. It's a long-term game. I'm not playing the finite game. It's constant curiosity. It's constantly, you're looking at things from a long point of view. And when you're, I got to admit, when you're 16 years old, sometimes it's hard to do that because this is the most important thing right now.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe not even 16. Sometimes it's like, you know, it's a very big deal because it's right here, right now. But life is so long. We have all this time to do all these different things, and that it is a process. Hence process over outcome. Any other pieces that you would add to help people on that?
A lot. So kids are often impacted by whether or not their parents are gritty. And so it's really important to, you know, show, don't tell. And when I spoke at a middle school, several middle schools in Plano, Texas, outside of Dallas, one of the things that really struck me, because I heard from school psychologists later on after I spoke about, you know, grit, and I talked about McRaven's Don't Ring the Bell speech and the rest of it. One of the things they decided to start at the school was a grit committee, and they realized that the students were not hearing stories of failure. And so they created the Stall Street Journal, which means that when you went into the bathrooms in these middle schools, you shut the door, and on the back was a laminated story of someone you would interact with, a cook, a crossing guard, a teacher, whatever. And it was their story of failure and how they overcame that challenge. Because, and then that was someone you could now approach. You could say, God, I read your story. How did you do it? And so if they don't grow up hearing that their parents struggled, that the people around them struggled, and that there is another day that's coming, you know, the sun will come up tomorrow, I think it can start to feel so overwhelming and so like, I'll never get through this. So we have to share stories of failure. I remember Angela telling me that the people in her lab thought, you know, everything she touched, she got the MacArthur Genius Grant Awards, like everything she touches is great. She's always succeeding. She started to post letters of rejection from journals she submitted to all over her office wall so that everybody who worked with her could see that she too didn't, you know, had to keep working hard. So I think that that's the last thing I would say is make sure you share with your children and the people around you that you too have failed. You too have come up short at times, but that you kept going.
And this might be, if I'm not mistaken, this is perhaps the biggest oxymoron I've ever heard, but your book on grit took a couple times to get out to what you wanted it to get out. I mean, oxymoron at its finest, right? You talk about grit, right? Tell me a little bit about that. You had grit in your own life.
Boy, you researched me. Yeah. So, I mean, I have been published by major publishers for years and creating your best life at number one in the goal setting world. And yet I couldn't get a publisher for getting grit. And my agent was so mystified. He's like, you have a really good reputation, the rest of it. He said, but here's what I'm hearing, Caroline. Everybody thinks that Angela Duckworth's book is the only book anyone's going to buy on grit because she got the largest advance in the history of psychology. And so I got so many rejections that one day I just wrote to Angela. I was like, nobody wants me. They only want you. She said, but that's awful. You have so much to say. That's so good. And so finally, Sounds True said, we had somebody drop out of our spring 2017 catalog. Do you have a book ready to go? It's like, yeah, I have been checking into hotels for months, just writing in free time. I would create these silos in hotels. And then they said, just as I was about to sign the contract, well, one more thing, Caroline, if we publish your book, will Angela Duckworth say nice things about it? And I just remember going, are you kidding me? Either you want me or you don't. And it's like, her book's coming out this week. You really want me to ask her? And they go, yeah, could you ask her? I emailed her. I'd say within an hour, she wrote back and said, of course, I'm going to say nice things about your book. I'll write a blurb. I'll do whatever. I tell everyone that story because it's a woman believing in another woman who had no reason to support me other than she thought I had something to say. So yeah, it took me a lot of grit to get that book out. And I remember despairing, thinking, this is one of the best books I've ever written. But you know what? Sometimes, you know, even when you have all the goods to succeed, life isn't always fair, but you do need to keep going. And when good people step in to support you, this is why the R is in relationships for the bridge methodology. Those people can drag you across the finish line if you've built those positive relationships, and you better be good at building relationships because it's not all about you all the time.
I think a good place to kind of end this is it's a very obvious place, but I think it needs to be mentioned that to me, and I've read some of your quotes just through Google images, is that grit is purely built outside of your comfort zone.
Yes.
Grit is not built sitting watching Netflix. And you and I laugh and we scoffle because we're like, yeah, obviously, right? But I think that needs to be said. I think it's a good thing just to remind people that, look, for you to build grit in the book, you had to go write the book, right? You had to step out of your comfort zone and do these things. Same thing with me on my pursuit with my book. So can we just, I think that'd be a good place to kind of end. I know it's obvious, but it's just a great reminder that you need to be out of your comfort zone. If somebody's listening, go, man, I love this. I want to have some grit. You got to get out of that comfort zone. Can you touch on that as we close down?
Yeah. Okay. So I do think in the process of pursuing a goal, you have to go out of your comfort zone, but there are character strengths and mindsets that you can build while you're not suffering necessarily. So while you're watching Netflix, if you want to keep having those next, you know, ones shoved at you and you're just going to sit there and your brainwaves are going to be like depressed brainwaves, you can build your self-regulation by standing up and walking away. So you can begin to build your willpower by saying no to things when it's hard. And that may not be part of pursuing a hard goal, but you're building the muscle of saying no to immediate gratification. That is important. Building passion. Stop dating so many interests and start zeroing in on something. When you see somebody who's just a dilettante doing a lot of things, they don't want to fail at anything, they do a lot of things. Zero in on something that really does interest you and dig in. So stop dating a lot of interest. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily involve grit, but boy, does that build the muscle of focus. So those are just some of the things. But yeah, when you're pursuing it, you're going to be out of your comfort zone. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable, and you'll be a better human being, and the people around you will be better because you did that.
Awesome. Caroline, you are a wealth of knowledge, and I had so much fun. This is a packed full conversation. I'm excited to get this out and share this with my listeners and for me to listen through it again. Where can my listeners best support you? I think first and foremost, before you answer, I'm going to say get this book, Getting Grit. You can get it pretty much anywhere online. Again, it's called Getting Grit, the evidence-based approach to cultivating passion, perseverance, and purpose. We scratched the surface on a lot of this. There's a lot of great stories in there.
Oh, we didn't talk about bad grit, did we?
We didn't. Do you want to touch on that? Do you feel passionate about that? We can do it if you'd like.
I do, because I really spent weeks and weeks in someone's house thinking about this. So there's bad grit. So we talked about good grit, but there's stupid grit, which is when you lock onto a goal and you have so much arrogance that you just don't disentangle yourself. Even it's like summit fever when you're climbing a mountain. And you see entrepreneurs who are convinced that this is the right way to pursue marketing or getting their thing out there. In the process, you know, they take the company down. So there's stupid grit. You can work too hard in the wrong ways. You can be like Lance Armstrong and you can have faux grit, performance enhancing drugs. You want people to think you're gritty, but you take shortcuts all over the place. You fake your PhD research. There's a lot of that going on right now. And then there's selfie grit. That's when you do hard things, but you tell everybody. All the time. It's like Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL who said, I shot Osama bin Laden. It was me. So you don't want to have those bad kinds of grit because that repels people. And good grit, you need to build bridges to other people because you can't do things. You have to do a lot of the hard work alone, but ultimately you got to have a soft place to fall. So bad grit repels, good grit attracts people.
Awesome.
I'll leave it there. And you can find me at my website.
Perfect. And your website is?
My name, CarolineMiller.com. And thank you. Thank you so much for letting me say that.
Absolutely. And we talked a little bit about the book that's coming out. Can you address that a little bit? What's going on?
So I am writing big goals because it's been 15 years since Creating Your Best Life came out. Still, the best, most evidence-based goal-setting book out there, but it's out of date. So what I'm doing is I'm making goal-setting sexy. I'm making Locke and Latham, the founders of goal-setting theory. I'm bringing them to prominence. They have just done the research. They don't have podcasts. They're not on stages. Nobody knows about them. So I'm bringing their work out and I'm giving a methodology that updates it because there's positive psychology, there's gender research, there's so many new things that we now know that we're missing when goal setting theory was published. One last thing I'll say is, as I studied the history of goal setting, and this has never been said before, every single method of goal setting that's been designed and put into practice in sports, in companies, has been designed by a white man. And so what's missing are all the nuances that you see when you have other voices in the room. And so I'm going to be the first woman to actually openly say that and put forward a theory that disrupts goal setting theory a little bit. But it had to be done because women are not allowed to be agentic and goal directed. It's stereotype threat. And so I'm updating goal setting theory with all the things that have just never really been brought up. So that book will be out in November and it's going to be a game changer.
Wow. I'm looking forward to getting my hands on that. Let's have you back on in November. We can talk okay. about it then.
Okay.
Awesome. Caroline, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.